You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And. Today we talked to longtime friend of the pod, Kim Scott, about the new book that she's got called Radical Respect. Check out our pod.
Another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Kim Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. I am thrilled to be chatting with you, Kelly Leonard.
Well, you are the, you and my wife, Anne, are the most frequent guests on this podcast. So that's pretty good company.
Excellent. I was just on, I was just at Anne's class. I taught with Anne.
Oh, at Northwestern?
It was really fun. Yeah.
Yeah. She loves those students. I mean, she's kind of teaching them how to do, you know, it's a lot of engineering students. She's trying to teach how to tell stories. Yeah. And how to you know, make themselves backable in a way. And that's, you know, and she went to Northwestern, so I think that's also a, you know, a thing.
Yeah.
So one of the things you and I have talked a lot about in the past is the importance of framing.
Yes.
Your ability to frame a problem or an opportunity can be equally, if not more important, to the actual tactics you enlist to solve that problem or meet that opportunity. And your last book, Just Work, had a framing problem, right?
Yes. So, I mean, part of the problem was that the title just didn't work. The title just work had in my mind anyway, a double entendre. And there were two problems with that double entendre. The first was that most people didn't get it. They thought I was telling them to return to office, which is not what the
not
book
what
was
doing.
About.
No.
And the second problem that I had no idea about is that a lot of people, like, to me, justice is all good. Like, but a lot of people have negative, they have a negative reaction to the word justice, which was a shock to me. I did not know that until after the book came out. And, you know, I'm a big believer that good communication is measured not at the speaker's mouth, but at the listener's ear. So I tried to fix just the title, but I also realized I was doing this podcast with Ernest Adams, who now leads DEI at Ford, and we would read a passage from the book, and I realized actually it was more than a framing problem. I wasn't finished editing the book.
Interesting.
I had kind of lost my voice, and I think I lost it because as a white woman, I felt like I had an extra obligation to write the book, and I also felt like I had no right to write the book at the same time. So I was very conflicted, and I think I didn't kind of resolve that inner conflict before Just Work came out. And so I spent another year really wrestling with every word in the book and reordering it and starting with what leaders can do, because leaders need to lead, but they can't address these problems alone.
Yeah, my follow-up was you changed more than the title, because I read Just Work twice, because I think I read it when you were working on it and
yeah.
Then its final version, and then I read this, and I mean how many words did you take out? 'Cause it felt to me like it was 10,000.
40,000.
40,000 words.
40,000 words. Yeah. So it's a lot shorter.
What kind of monster were you to do a book that had 40,000 words we didn't want?
Yes, that was monstrous. I blame it partly on COVID. I was sitting up there all alone in the shed, yes, in my backyard, and I was writing and writing and writing and writing and writing.
Oh my God, 40,000. That is
40,000 words. It's really,
significant.
it is hard. It is really hard to cut that many words. It's like, but writing is editing. It was necessary.
So one of my next podcasts is with a guy, Todd Rogers. He's at Harvard, and it's a book on writing. And a mutual friend, a guy who was on the podcast, recommended it, and I always like, great, yeah, let's do this. But I sort of went into the book like, I write. What do I need? And it's so refreshing because he's basically sort of saying, you might have learned the five-paragraph essay. Awesome. This five-paragraph essay gave me an advantage at work in a big way. But modern communication requires you to get across your point in a way briefer.
Yeah, you get 5 words, not 5 paragraphs.
And still, if you want to communicate well, you have to choose those 5 words in a way that makes someone want to read your 50 words than your 500 words. It's like we're not getting rid of more words
Yeah.
necessarily.
But you need to sell somebody. I mean, like Dickens, I love Dickens, but you have to read 100 pages before you like it. You know? And I don't know if that will work. I hope somebody still reads Dickens in 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, I would say George Saunders, who I'd say is in some ways a contemporary, has these big old books. But also, I mean, there's a brevity to his sentences, and
You get into George Saunders immediately, though. You know, he knows he's got to hook you
Grab
right
you.
away.
In chapter one, you write, quote, "The word respect has two very different meanings. The first has to do with admiration for someone's abilities, qualities, or achievements. That kind of admiration has to be earned, but that's not what I'm talking about in this book." What are you talking about?
I am talking about the kind of respect that is the regard that we owe to each other for our shared humanity, for the other person's emotions, for who they are. And that is, I think, a birthright. It's something that we owe each other. Like, when my children were very small, there were 2 rules in our house. You have to be respectful and you have to be safe. And that was it. You could do anything else as long as you were respectful and not putting yourself or others in physical harm. And it is really, I think, important. And it's interesting, I have twins, a boy and a girl, and I also had to I may be taking us down a rat hole we don't want to go down. But I had to equate in our house sort of physical and verbal violence because one of them was bigger and better at hitting the other, and the other was way better verbally and would prompt him to hit her. And I had to make sure that I was being fair to both of them by sort of equating those 2 things.
I wonder too, that message, that idea of this sort of respect that we should have for everyone simply because they're born. That, because I talk about that a lot in a very different way through our work, and it is to the audiences that I'm in front of, they love it and they get it. And there are other audiences, maybe younger people, maybe people not who are in these companies that are bringing in people like me to speak, who are they question it. They see the privilege. They right? I mean, like you must encounter that too.
I think that in general, when I say we owe it to each other to have regard for each other's sort of feelings, backgrounds, lived experiences, in general, it's kind of hard, even among younger conservative audiences. Even when I go back to Memphis and speak at my high school, there's a lot of head nodding for that. It's obviously I get the head nodding with a younger, more liberal audience, but I found that respect is something that it. Nothing is universal. And it's, of course, confusing that there's these 2 different definitions. But just saying we owe each other. Maybe I should have called it radical regard, but regard is a more nuanced word.
Yeah.
But we owe it to each other to have regard for the other person that we're interacting with, no matter who they are. I think people have a hard time arguing with that.
I would think so.
But I'm sure I will encounter it, and that's good. I'm not. In fact, if nobody argues with what I'm saying, it's probably not very interesting. So it's okay. You know, I'm all about radical candor. Be radically candid if you disagree with me on the universal regard definition of respect. But language is so interesting. I mean, that one word would have two such different meanings is very confusing.
Yeah. Yeah, I immediately, when you said radical regard, I was like, no, just because of like the Kelly selling books part of me would be like, it's not going to sell books.
Yeah.
But in fact, I think it is a better word because it softens what you're saying in terms of like, if you're going to say that we can't regard the other, you are venturing down monstrous territory.
Yes, you are. It's true. Although I would also say there may be some regard implies vision, which I don't mean, you know, this is not, it may be ableist. Like in the book I talk about, somebody pointed out to me that I use the word see when what I really mean is notice. And even after I understood this and thought I had fixed it, I did a search in the book, and there were 99 times when I had used sloppy sight metaphors. So it's tricky.
Yeah. I know we talked about this last time, but I think it's important because I like this very much in the original version of the book, is trying to look at the where these problems come from, and you sort of cite three areas, bias, prejudice, and bullying, and they're different.
Yes.
But this is not something in your standard, Laurel, our head of human HR here, did one of these DEI seminars yesterday.
Uh-huh.
And left the office to come in to sit in my office and just like sigh because nothing was being said. They weren't discerning these things. It was all bumper stickers.
Yeah.
Talk a bit about these three different things, bias, prejudice, and bullying, and why it's important to understand these differences in any, we say the workplace, but I think you mean anywhere.
Yes. So I think that it's interesting to think about what gets in the way of the kind of respect we were just talking about, this regard that we owe to everyone. And I mean, there's a million things, but I'm going to boil it down to three big ones: bias, prejudice, and bullying. And I think when we talk about those problems, we conflate them as though they're one problem, one monolithic problem. And when you conflate three different problems and assume it's a monolithic problem, it's easy to give way to despair and to feel like, I can't solve, it's like a hard word problem. My kids are struggling with those a lot in math. And so what do you do when you're confronted with a hard problem? You break it down into its parts and you solve one at a time. And so for that reason, I tried to offer some overly simple definitions for bias, prejudice, and bullying so that in the moment, you could have a guess as to which it was and then a better idea of how to respond. So bias I define as not meaning it. It's unconscious. Mm-hmm. Whereas prejudice I'm going to define as meaning it. Very simple. Bias includes a very consciously held belief, usually incorporating some kind of unfair and inaccurate stereotype. And bullying is not about belief, conscious or unconscious. It's just about being mean. So not meaning it, and being mean. And you can guess from those definitions that you're going to have to respond to those three different things very differently.
So bullying to me is easy to understand, and easy to understand of like why we don't like that. And that's,
although it's interesting, we don't create consequences for it. Like I was starting in school, So, bullying is easier to understand, but I think the conventional wisdom is ignore it. And I don't think that's a good idea.
No, I think, okay, so you're right on that. That's a systems problem, among other things. Bias, of course, is something that we all have.
Yes.
That is not necessarily negative. If we didn't have it, life would take way longer. just to
yeah. get yeah. We no. would never drive a car.
No, we would never drive
example.
A car. For example. So there's more to uncover there. This prejudice thing is interesting, and I'm going to tell on myself.
Okay.
I had my last a couple podcast guests ago was Emily Freeman, mm-hmm. who wrote a book How to Walk into a Room. And she is not only Christian, she works in Christian spaces. Mm-hmm. And I, as I started to read the book, I'm like, and I was brought up Christian, I was brought up Catholic. I have a prejudice. I just mm-hmm. do. And I had to be sort of really conscious of that and step out and go, what is that? And again, it comes from some lived experience that I had in those spaces. It is not fair to everyone. I think I upset myself enough in sort of this moment to then have this really wonderful conversation with this woman and kind of trade some emails afterwards. But it is not, the bias thing is easy because you can kind of let yourself off the hook. The yeah. prejudice thing's much harder.
Yeah, the prejudice thing is much, much harder. And I mean, I have a story that is easier to tell because okay. it's kind of funny and it's me in high school. But I went to an all-girls school, and I was in a family that was very dominated by women. My great-grandmother had divorced her husband, taken her daughters, her four daughters, out of Galveston, taken them to Memphis, raised them by herself, and these women were indomitable. And I went to a church that was founded by a woman. Actually, so I was raised as a Christian Scientist, mm-hmm. and that church was founded by Mary Baker Eddy. And so I believed, and this was like a consciously held belief, I believed that women were superior to men from the time I was very, I just thought, and I thought every, I don't know how I managed to dodge everything in the media, but.
Yeah, right.
But somehow I had this belief. This was my lived experience. And not that I thought my father was inferior to my mother. Like like a lot of beliefs that you form when you're very young, you don't really question it or notice even obvious facts. And I was a senior in high school and reading Wordsworth when it occurred to me that, oh my gosh, a man wrote that. And it was a big relief to like, cause then I realized, oh, I don't have to marry some sort of, I had wrestled with my sexuality. I knew I was gonna wind up, with a partner who was a man. And I was sort of dreading this like inferior beast I was gonna have to hitch my wagon. And it was like a big relief to let go of that, of all those prejudices. But, and it's embarrassing to sort of say, in fact, when I wrote that, my father read it and it upset him. He's like, but what about your grandfather? He had the response that you might expect, but there it is. Like sometimes these beliefs lodge in our heads when we're very young and they grow there, especially if we don't examine them. So I think the really important thing is to examine your beliefs and question them. Because if you don't, then your beliefs become prejudices.
And I think you touched on this. It is so rooted in our family stories, our family scripts.
Yes.
And this prejudice of mine comes from incidents and knowledge of what was going on in some of those spaces, some of those Christian spaces. Mm-hmm. But I also equally remember my brother Colin, who was very active in sort of civil rights mm-hmm. situations, not allowing a slur to exist in the house, like irate. And I just mm-hmm. Remember that being modeled for me by him in a way that I was like, oh, okay, he's right. Like yeah. This is something. And I don't know that I have that opinion if I don't have that from my brother.
Yeah.
Growing up in like a completely white, rich suburb. In Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's, you've got, you, the examining of your family stories, which mm-hmm. is something people should do in therapy, yes. is really important.
Yeah. Yeah. Really important and really interesting. I mean, I think we approach that kind of examination with a sense of dread, But sure. In fact, if you're dragging some kind of irrational belief around you, like it's a huge relief to put that down. Huge relief. It's I mean, I think that one of the things that I hope that I did in Radical Respect is to make approaching these topics, there's an element of fun and it's not all trauma, you know. It's like there is trauma, and I don't want to deny that there's, but it's also, it's really a relief to realize, oh, I thought I believed that thing, and I realize I don't believe that thing. In fact, I think that is why I love to write. What I do when I write is I root around in my own head, and I have these arguments with myself. Do I believe this or do I believe that? And it's fun, I think.
Yeah, Vonnegut said writing is an act of discovery.
Yes.
So I think that approach is great. You write in the book, quote, self-righteous shaming is an act of vengeance, not repair. Man, yes.
We got a lot of self-righteous shaming.
Oh my God. And everyone's doing it. It's the hottest thing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think that everyone's doing it online. It's less likely to happen. It's less likely to happen in person. And there's interesting research. You probably know more about this than I do, Kelly, but if you're at a dinner, let's say you're at a dinner party and you say you indulge in some self-righteous shaming, the cues that was not a good idea are subtle. It's like the eye roll, the silence, and that kind of subtlety doesn't exist in online spaces. And so somebody is going to give you a thumbs up. In fact, Zoom just gave me a thumbs up when I did that. I don't know how to turn that off. Somebody's going to give you a thumbs up or a like or something when you indulge in self-righteous shaming online, but you're not going to get any of the negative signals. And so people are much more likely to do this in an online, you know, in writing, in an asynchronous way than they are if they're with people. Even on a Zoom, I think, you don't have to be around a table at a dinner party. I don't know. That's what do you think about that?
Well, okay, so the context I think about it, which is, so I'm still on Twitter, which I refuse to call X.
Yeah, I agree.
Because I'm petty. But one of the things I recognized, because I didn't trust the algorithm, and recognizing that I was, as I dunk on people, I wouldn't dunk on people, but I'd like people who are dunking on people, I stopped doing that.
Yes, yeah.
And guess what? The algorithm doesn't serve me up as much of that dunking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That is interesting. I mean, I think that if Twitter were owned by somebody different, I would recommend that they create an eye roll emoji, you know? And then people get a negative signal when they indulge in this self-righteous shaming. Somebody told me a story about that sort of illustrates the problem with self-righteous shaming. There was a company, and there was an individual at this company who was Ohlone, who was Native American. Ohlone is not the right there. Ohlone describes a variety of different Native Americans in California, and this person wanted for a social event to do a powwow. But a lot of people didn't know that this person's background was Ohlone. And all these people piled on, you're appropriating. So there was a lot of self-righteous shaming. Uh-huh. And then, of course, all these people who were indulging in the self-righteous shaming look like assholes when the person said, no, I'm not appropriating. But it was not, it was really a shame that the event actually got canceled because of the self-righteous shaming. And the person felt terrible, you know, everybody felt terrible. And so I really hope you know me, I love a good 2x2. So radical respect is what happens when you optimize for collaboration rather than coercion, and where you respect everyone's individuality. So it's a kind of environment where the strength of the individual is the team and the strength of the team is the individual. So that's what we're shooting for. If you try to coerce others into respecting someone's individuality, it's not going to work. You're going to get self-righteous shaming. And often somebody warns me, like, self-righteous shaming is is the tool of the powerless. And you don't want to rob them of that tool, Kim. And I recognize that there's some merit in that feedback to my my recommendation not to indulge in self-righteous shaming. But it just doesn't work. So I would like to give the powerless tools that work. And this is one that doesn't work.
That is a great point. I fear this is I was going to call it a right-wing term. But it's a certain kind of right-wing term. Was cry bullies when people use that term. But I kind of like it.
It's not only a right wing. It's also like white women's tears is an example of cry bullying. You know?
Yeah.
And I'm very, I was raised in the South. I'm very familiar with cry bullying.
Because I have friends on social who kind of live in that space, and I get it. I mean, they feel seen when they post things like that, and they're kind of doing it because they don't feel seen. And I'm very blessed that I am in a position
where seen, yeah.
I feel seen, yeah. and that's. But I also feel like, yeah, well, I put myself in a position to feel seen. I work very hard at that. And you also talk about this in the book, which I think is connected, which is the importance of vulnerability and not letting people rob you of your vulnerability.
Yeah.
That's a different thing than just this talk about, because it's very much like that, bring yourself to work. You're like, can we bring ourselves to work?
It's can we bring our whole selves to work?
We're many selves.
Yes, many selves. And when we have real relationships at work, we can bring our, maybe not our fullest, but our fuller selves to work. I think that the problem with bullying is that in order to respond to bullying, you don't want to make yourself vulnerable to the bully, right? So my daughter explained this to me. She was in third grade. She was getting bullied on the playground. And I was telling her to say to this child, I feel sad when you blah, 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 blah. She banged her fist on the table and she said, Mom, they are trying to make me feel sad. Why would I tell them they succeeded? I'm like, ooh, really good point. And so you don't want to tell the bully that they've made you feel sad. You want to say, you can't talk to me like that. You want to use a you statement that kind of pushes them away. Or a you non sequitur. Where'd you get the shirt, that shirt? That's actually advice from a dominatrix. There you go. You can get advice from all kinds of places. So that I think is really important. But I also told my daughter, you don't want to pretend that you're not sad when you come home and talk to me, You don't want to pretend that you're not sad when you're talking to your best friend. Otherwise, because if we don't share our vulnerabilities and our emotions with the people who are close to us and who we can trust, then we're not going to build relationships. Vulnerability is a big part of relationships. So, again, this is like part of breaking this problem apart. No, you don't want to show your vulnerability to someone who is bullying you, but you do want to show it to someone who cares about you.
So that makes me think about the use of humor, because that can be such a powerful tool in your arsenal to deflate, deflect, to connect.
Yeah.
And because it is very hard for someone to be mean or fearful when they're laughing.
Yes. And humor, I think, is, your wife writes about this, ha ha, aha. Like the evolutionary purpose of humor is to help people notice things they're reluctant to notice. And so humor is really an important part of what I tried to bring to Radical Respect. And in fact, when you and I did at a certain large tech company, we did a session together around using some improv exercises around some of the ideas in Radical Respect. And somebody said to me at the end of it, oh, it was such a relief to laugh about these things, Because I think we bring such heaviness to this discussion. And And there is reason for that. Like, there are people who are truly traumatized. So you can use humor to distance yourself from real emotions. And that is an abuse of humor. But there are also, like, a lot of situations that are funny and illustrative. And I think the more we can talk about those, the better. Especially when it comes to bullying. Like that, if you can laugh at a bully, that is a way. And laughing at, not with, you know, that's one way to push them away. If you can get that bully laughing with you, then you've really pulled off a trick.
So, again, it might be a framing thing. So Anne and I were both asked to basically lecture in a class. So these are all graduating medical students, fourth mm-hmm. year. And this class is about humor and medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And because Anne and I both have this experience in creating the Improv for Caregivers program and our own experience with our daughter, we were able to sort of talk to them. And as we were sort of, they were asking a lot of good questions about, like, because everyone's a little scared of using humor. And I was like, all right, let's not call it humor for a second. Let's call it play and connect. So creating a playful situation that mm-hmm. allows you to be a little vulnerable, mm-hmm. to find points of connection. That allow mm-hmm. because this is the other thing I sort of said, the science backs me up on this, I know, which is that people don't tell you the truth for
yes.
a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
And humor is often, really good humor especially, is a lot of truth telling, sort of mm-hmm. slowly at first and then maybe more. And so mm-hmm. creating a playful environment where people will offer up specifics that allow you to sort of see the truth of the situation they're in.
Yeah.
How invaluable is that?
Yeah.
In a critical situation, a medical situation.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. In fact, you know, one of the people who works on the Radical Candor team participates in that program, has found it invaluable. And I think, like, part of humor is storytelling. And the basic rule is show, don't tell.
Yeah.
And so instead of saying, you know, my leg hurts, you know, say, look, when I was trying to get up from the couch, my daughter called me an old lady butt scooching, which really happened the other day.
Right.
That's how it hurt. I couldn't get up from the couch, but it was kind of a funny, I forgot exactly how she put it. I tell you, these kids these days, they have a funny way of putting things. So I think that's exactly right. Like, getting people comfortable. When I talk to people about being an upstander and the importance of that, I tell a story about being in a meeting. I was giving a presentation to 5,000 people with two other colleagues. And when the person who led that organization introduced us, he introduced the first guy, shook his hand, introduced the second guy, shook his hand, introduced me, and I stuck my hand out for him to shake it. And instead, he grabbed it and he kissed it, kind of like licked it. Slobbered. I know, disgusting. And that was, like, not ideal. But much worse was the fact that not a single person of those 5,000 came up to me afterwards and said, you know, do you need a little hand sanitizer? Or, you know, that was weird. And then I was like, was I the only person who thought that was weird? And then I started to feel gaslit. And so it's really important as an upstander to check in with someone after the event. And I think explaining why, you could, you know, just saying it's important to check in with someone, you're not going to remember that. But you're going to remember to offer the person hand sanitizer if you see them get their hand licked, you know.
Yeah.
You remember to check in later if you hear the story. So I think you're right. Like, that show don't tell is really important.
I want to ask you about another thing, because I used a term, this is a while ago, I used a term that used to get used a lot here, which is, let's assume good intent.
Yes, this is a big one.
Yeah, okay, so, and then I was told that was not a good thing for me to say.
So, here's the deal. I think it is good advice to, when I am the person who's been harmed by some kind of disrespectful attitude or behavior, when I'm experiencing bias, prejudice, or bullying, I think it's a good idea for me to assume good intent, because it makes it easier for me to solve the problem, to talk to the person. However, if I am the person who has caused harm, if I am the person who someone else is has experienced bias, prejudice, or bullying from me, if I've been disrespectful in some way and someone tells me that, it's a terrible idea for me to demand that they assume good intent of me, because then I'm denying the impact of what I said or did. And the first thing I need to do if I have been disrespectful is to be aware of what I did wrong and to acknowledge it. And so I think it's useful. We have such, again, such angst around disrespect or bias, prejudice, or bullying. So let's talk about stepping on someone's toe, which is a less fraught situation. Mm-hmm. If I am stepping on your toe and you tell me, Kim, you're stepping on my toe, I would not say, oh, I didn't mean to, and continue to stand there on your toe. Like, I would just get off your damn toe.
Right.
And I think that's assuming good intent can be a useful thing for one to do when one is being disrespected. However, it is a terrible thing if you are the disrespecter to demand that the person who's just told you that you've been disrespectful, it's a terrible idea to demand that they assume good intent of you. So it kind of depends on who you are and what the situation is.
I know we just mentioned this Vonnegut quote of the act of writing is discovery. And I think this podcast is a little bit, because what I'm realizing that we're doing is we're parsing words.
Yes.
Which is kind of, in many ways, the point, because I was just about to do it again, and I'm going to. I had a note here about hierarchies. And right before we started taping, I'm interviewing Renee Fleming for the Chicago Humanities Festival. She's edited this book called Music and Mind, and it's a bunch of essays around, you know, the arts and medicine and health. And the great Anna Deavere Smith has this essay that I'm in the middle of reading in a section that's called Healing Arts. And she writes, hierarchy is a friend of efficiency and necessary for those who need to make sure everyone is in their place. That's understandable if one is herding sheep or making tires for a car, but not if one is devoted to cultivating creativity. Eased hierarchical structures are essential to creativity. Creativity requires mobility. Love it.
Yes.
First of all, you also talk about hierarchy in the book.
Yeah, I mean, hierarchy, I do think, is a fact of life of when we're collaborating. You do need, I mean, even in an orchestra, you need a conductor, mostly. I mean, there are those that, but as a general rule, it's useful to have a conductor.
Yes.
But I think it's really important to remember that people who occupy roles in hierarchies, it is a job that they're doing, and it is a job for which they get held accountable. And it does not mean that they are superior. Like, the language that we use around hierarchy is part of the problem with hierarchy, because it assumes sort of like a fundamental attribution error, like my superior. Like, I hate, every time I hear that, I cringe, because your boss is not your superior. Your boss is your boss, and your boss has a job, and their job is to help you succeed. You know?
Yeah.
And if they're not helping you succeed, then they need to be held accountable for failing to help you succeed. And so I think that hierarchy is necessary. Like, when I write, there's a hierarchy in my book, but I just think that's part of how we get things done. And it's even more important. I mean, when I write, it's never me writing. I'm always writing in community with other people. And getting the hierarchy of the book right is very important. That's part of what I got wrong in Just Work and what I fixed, I think, in Radical Respect. But that doesn't mean that so you can't have chaos, but you also need flexibility. You need to be able to change things around. And so, you know, in an ideal world, I think there would be more rotating leadership roles, more rotating managerial roles, so that more people could be in the hot seat. Because being like, I'm a CEO coach, and I always feel bad for these people who are CEOs. This is a terrible job. It is a really terrible job. And you know, people don't realize that. They strive to get it, and then they get it, and they're like, oh, this sucks. And I think if we had more we'd have more compassion for our leaders, and we would hold them accountable more. I mean, the problem is power. Hierarchy is good, power is bad, I would say. And so we can unpack what I mean by that if you want. But
well, what you're making me think of is a conversation we've taped with Elias Abujadeh, which really he goes after the fetish of leadership in this country. We're obsessed with it. We're obsessed with it. And it's like, and it makes people who are not leaders necessarily feel bad.
Bad,
and And as you're talking about this, like, I talk about my boss. I have a great boss, my boss, Ed Wells. I love him. Mm-hmm. He is my boss. I don't feel any less than him. And I know he doesn't
feel superior to you.
He does not feel superior to me in any regard. And Elias, in this, we have not talked about this, but apparently at Harvard in one of their exec education programs, one of their very expensive programs, you don't need any, there's no qualifications for entering this other than giving them a check for like $50,000.
Yeah.
And then if you give them,
that's a qualification.
That's a qualification. And then if you give them an extra $8,000, here's two things you get. You get, alumni status and a lifetime Harvard email.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Wow.
And Kim, this isn't just Harvard. This is Wharton. This is Kellogg. This is, they all do this. What is happening?
I think a big part of dealing with power in a hierarchy is creating checks and balances in a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And our economic system does not have the notion of checks and balances.
Incentives are bad. Yeah, the incentives are terrible. Yes.
Yeah. It's anyway. We can do a whole other podcast on capitalism, but that's another topic. So I think that power is bad. Power does bad things to people. Full stop. And powerlessness is also bad.
Also bad.
You know, that's the other, like, that's a coin with two bad sides. Mm-hmm. And so I think but we do need authority. We do need to organize if we're going to collaborate well. And we do need some process. Like, I hate bureaucracy, but I love a good process. Because it means I can do my work and not get bogged down in all this other junk. And so I think that it is really important that we have some checks and balances and that leaders get held accountable for doing their job in a hierarchy, as opposed to, you know, I'm the boss and now all the rest of you all have to do what I say. Like, telling people what to do just doesn't work.
All right, I'm dying to tell you about this study that I came across, which is going to lead
to our
final question. So we always ask the guest for a yes and story. You've done that. Then returning guest, we ask you for thank you because you've done that. So right before we got, I'm like, oh, my God, I don't have a story. I'm like, wait, I want to tell you about this study.
Okay.
So Vanessa Bonds, Rachel Schlund, and Rosanna Summers did a study, and this is around saying no.
Okay.
And what they did is they had two cohorts. The first cohort that came into the room, they said to them, before we begin the study, can you please unlock your phone and hand it to me? I'll just need to take your phone outside of the room for a moment to check some things. If you'd like to refuse, you may do so. Refusing will not affect your payment or participation in the study. That's the first group.
Okay.
Second group. They said, before we begin the study, can you please unlock your phone and hand it to me? I'll just need to take your phone outside of the room for a moment to check some things. If you'd like to refuse, please say the words, I'd rather not. Refusing will not affect your payment or participation in the study. So the difference there was when people were handed a script, it made them more willing and it was easier for them to say no.
So in the first group, how many said no? And in the second group, how many said no?
It was a 70-30 difference.
Wow. That's incredible. So a lot of people allowed their phone to be unlocked and taken out of the room because they were so reluctant to say no.
Yeah, and you've seen other studies like this, right? Where you'd like people just ask people like you know, give me directions or actually walk me somewhere and they'll do it. And so but the idea that is so connected to things we've talked about is, oh, when boundaries are important, that's when the script is important. You are no longer improvising.
Yeah. It is really useful to have script. And it's really hard to say no. I don't know if you, we were chatting earlier when I lived and worked in Russia. I was early in my career and I was really ambitious and I said yes, any project, any work that needed doing. And somebody at one point looked at me and I was frazzled. I was like, I had burnt myself way out. I was like crisp. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, Kim, you are acting like Gaspaja Da again. You've got to learn to say no to things. And this was a struggle for me. Like saying no was something I struggled with for years and years and years. And there were a couple of things that really helped. One was when I was working at Google, I had a great boss. And I still had this habit. I was more aware of it, but I still had this habit of saying yes to everything and burning myself out. And she recommended that I start a proactive forbearance list. At first she called it a do not do list, but that felt bad to me. But proactive forbearance, you know, that felt awesome. That was my no list. Mm-hmm. And she said, flip your emotions. And if you do any of the things on your proactive forbearance list, feel guilty about doing them. Don't feel guilty about not doing them. That was incredibly helpful. So that's one no story. Another one was when I got to Apple. Apple was very much a no, like Google was a yes culture and Apple was a no culture. Mm-hmm. And there was an engineer, a designer at Apple who, when he hired someone new, would show him his yes folder and his no folder. And so his no folder was all the ideas he had had that had been rejected, that his, you know, team and his boss had said no to. And it was huge, the no folder. The yes folder had like four ideas in it. Mm-hmm. And that reminded people that it was really, they needed to keep coming up with ideas and not to get discouraged by the no's, because it was Apple's this, you know, we're going to focus on a few things and only a few things. And we're going to say no. It's easy to say no to bad ideas, but to say no to great ideas is really hard. But if you don't say no to great ideas, then you're not going to have enough time for the things that you really want to do. And so I actually designed a class when I was teaching at Apple called Saying No in a Way That Strengthens Your Relationships. Mm. And that, because I think we fear that saying no is going to hurt our relationships. And that's why we're so reluctant to do it. But it is possible to say no in a way that shows the other person that you care about them, you care about their priorities, and explains why you're not going to do that thing.
So it seems totally the same thing we were talking about with the hierarchy. Which is like, well, yeah, you need it, and there's some inherent problems, so you've got to look at the and I mean, and again, this is life. There's no yes without no. You know, there's no happiness without sorrow. This is like the yin and the yang of all of it, and it is just so difficult for us human beings not to look for a solution A that means that B is wrong.
Yeah, that we always do. But I think yes and is actually a good way to say no in a way that strengthens your relationships. Yes, that's a great idea. And there's no way I'm going to have time to do it the next.
I don't know if that counts as yes. Yeah, that's not a yes, but that's I really like this idea and I don't have time. So what else can we do in this moment?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a real thing. But I also feel like, understanding that we get asked to do things that we don't want to do a lot, and we have to create these boundaries, that this idea of like, we've got to be responsible for each other. So yes. I have to be able to hand you a script saying, hey, I'd love you to be involved in this project. I think it's a great thing. If you don't want to do it, say to me, Kelly, I don't want to do it. It's fine. Yes. And then that permission could mean everything, because we don't know. What's going on in their world.
Yeah. And it happens all the time that you have a meeting with someone and you want me to do this thing and I don't want to say no. And we leave the meeting with you thinking that I've said yes and me thinking that I've said no. I mean, that happens all the time in every different kind of situation. When I was at when I was at Google, my coach, Fred Kaufman, drew this infinite damage to your relationships. And basically, it was about saying no in a way that, and so on the vertical line was damage to the relationship, and on the horizontal line was time. And if you have to tell someone that you're not going to do something, if you have to tell them no, and you tell them, you know, 4 weeks before they're expecting it, then you do very little damage to your relationship. But the closer you get to the deadline, the more damage. And if you tell them after they expected it that actually you're not going to do it, then you're approaching infinite damage to your relationships. And maybe damage to your relationships is a strong way to put it, but you do damage to your, you know, reputation as a reliable colleague, that's for sure.
The book is called Radical Respect. Kim Scott, thank you so much for coming on the podcast again.
Thank you.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.